Hi, I'm Jim Stogdill.
I'm Ed Dumbbell.
I'm Roger Magoulis.
And we are here in Sebastopol, California, and getting ready to have a conversation about in-memory databases, an area Roger has been spending a lot of time on.
Yeah, so I'll just start off. I mean, the main reason you want to do in-memory data management is real-time. It's probably the kind of one that first comes to mind. But I think the one that's really getting more interest than where a lot is going on is around analyst productivity. And a lot of it has to do with these new distributed systems are batch-oriented, and if an analyst really wants to get into some data and be iterative and learn and discover, that's not the best kind of architecture for doing that. So if you can put things fast, then you can just do more work. And I know as an analyst myself, that's pretty important. And we see more and more companies creating this kind of new workflow where there's an ingestion engine and then there's an analytic engine. And I think what makes it different than the kind of classic data warehouse is that it's really easy to spin up another thing into the analytic engine. So you can create something that meets like a lot of people's needs, but when you have something weird, you can then go in and pull something out.
So Roger, that makes some kind of sense, right? And obviously the MapReduce and the batch stuff is so you can get hold of a big lot of data. The in-memory is so we can make big data interactive to some extent. But naive question, isn't it going to be easy to do some kind of interactive query that brings the whole data set into memory anyway and it just breaks down and degrades? I mean, what is there typical usage patterns that mean that memory is feasible?
Yeah, I'd say one thing is 10 terabytes or less is the sweet spot for it. There's certain tasks that lend itself better. Low cardinality, integer data is the easiest thing to do things on.
So what would that kind of be?
If you have time series, like big time series data, anything that's measured, you do it. Also counts. So you associate, like you can classify things, and then you have counts of things over time, and you're looking for rates of change. That's another one that fits in. If you think about in-memory, right, it tends to be columnar because memory is a scarce resource. So you're trying to limit I/O and compression. Most of the algorithms use some kind of compression, and even just columns is a form of compression itself. Well, that's where you're going to get the kind of biggest speed boost to do things. Now, I do a lot with semi-structured text data, you know, regexes and stuff like that. The boost is a little bit different, but it's still there if you can fit the stuff in into memory.
So, right now we're hearing a lot of vendors talking about in-memory and so on. And as usual, the waves of fashion wash over us. And also, I don't want to be buying, you know, N different database systems for N different kind of workloads when I'm coming from a heritage of being able to do anything off a Unix workstation, basically. So is it the case right now in the architectures you've seen that you then have to buy, you know, another set of boxes for an in-memory analytics cluster as well as your Hadoop cluster?
Yeah, I think that there's like an asymptote, right? You don't need a lot of different clusters, but your ingestion engine, that's a particular workload, and your analytic engine is a bit of a different workload that might need a bit of a different configuration. And so the notion of, I mean, you can put things, you can actually co-locate them, and that's not a big problem. But you're going to have these kind of different usage patterns. You know, one is very write intensive, the other is really more read intensive. And so I think if you just look at the logical architecture and then see how your workload is, if I'm talking 10 terabytes as a sweet spot, I mean, if you spend a lot of money on RAM. I mean, you've got to RAM things up. If you have a big Hadoop cluster, you might not have anywhere near that kind of RAM. So one, you've got to configure things so that if in-memory is going to help you out, then, you know, that's what you would like size things to be. And RAM is still pretty expensive.
So can you talk a bit about the products that people are using? Because this is very abstract, but, you know, am I going to be able to use SQL and, you know, have Tableau running on top of this? Is this what making big data, you know, normal as far as regular analysts is concerned?
Yeah, I would say there's a meta trend that I think I've brought up in other areas that SQL still matters a lot. And you look at what's going on when you're trying to get a big audience and you want to really get more people into the data. And I think a lot of companies are trying to be more like kind of quantitative or data oriented. then SQL is going to have a pretty big installed resource base, and a lot of tools will plug into it. So even folks who don't have SQL now have that on their radar. And it might be a simplified SQL, but people are doing, when you think about analytic data, usually the data structures are much simpler than for a transactional system. So you can, it's more easy to have a simpler SQL be good enough. So at that low end, you've got like these tableaus and click views actually have an in-memory piece to them.
Right.
And the theory is that you're sucking stuff in and you can manipulate and explore mm-hmm. using some kind of cube or dimensional model what you're looking at. There's something like SciSense, which is pretty sophisticated in that it throws stuff in L1, L2, and L3 cache. There's extreme management mm-hmm. of those fast resources to try to make redrawing things quick.
Right.
And so you get like, I don't know if I call it next generation BI, but this notion of a lot of density, particularly visual density, in what is displayed.
So that's interesting because you mentioned the cache, right? And I've noticed this is a trend that particularly with scale-out data applications, you need to start paying a lot more attention to the hardware than you ever did before. You know, it used to be, well, you get enough memory, enough disk, and a fast SCSI bus or whatever, and you're golden. But now we have things like at one extreme where Facebook is building data centers out of one hardware configuration for old photos, right, to give a power and performance balance that they want. So you mentioned that cache, but I we're also in a world where we have a plummeting price of SSDs, for instance. Can you talk a bit about the hardware configurations that you're seeing emerging to take advantage of this?
Yeah, one thing is I think looking out to the future, and I'll bring up a kind of, I don't know, a metaphor, an analogy, but when you buy your an iPad, do you know how much RAM there is in it? You don't, because they only advertise the SSD.
Right.
Right? Is that, I think in the future that might be,
well, tell us then, how
things go.
How much?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know either. Because it doesn't matter. Right? Because SSD is pretty damn fast with the kind of applications that are there. SSDs are going to get faster. You know, right now, DynamoDB, the Amazon key value store, runs on SSDs. Hmm. So it's a form of in-memory. So I think, like, you look now, there's things that do cache.
Yeah.
And they're pretty, they'll run on lots of different hardware. I mean, you might want to, the software people might have some hardware manufacturers that they, you know, have a better fit with. And then there's lots of RAMs. I mean, it blows my mind from how old I am that 128 gig RAM is now like a typical beefy server. But so you're getting to see a lot of RAM, and there's going to be denser RAM coming down the road. It's not going to be faster, but you can get denser and more in.
So, to the ultimate, so the ultimate conclusion where are we headed, right? I mean, that we'll not have spinny disks anymore, I think.
Well, there'll be tape. They'll be like tape.
Yeah.
And when you're doing data, and you're doing what we used to call a full table scan, but the notion of almost every action is scanning everything, disk is really fast, and it's a lot cheaper. So there are applications where...
So disk is still faster for sequential?
It's not faster, it's equivalent. It's not faster.
Right, but, okay, what's the word? The cost-performance balance...
Is better. It's a better value.
Still with spinning disk for serial access, basically.
Yes. Yes.
So it really is like tape, where we used to say tape was for sequential access and disk was for random access.
Yeah, and that's the key word, is that random part. Is that there's, even when you're doing analysis, at some point you're getting into it, and the randomness is a big deal. And I think that having random is, there's a lot of speed differential. There's also, in most cases, this should be easier to share. If you've pegged something up in RAM, if two people are in it, they're just pointing. There isn't a disk that needs to spin or a head that needs to change where it's at, what track it's on. So sharing feasibly is, not everyone is doing it in the software, but it should be easier to do. So that means more connections and stuff like that.
I mean, just going up a level for a second, Roger, I mean, what's sort of fundamentally different now? I mean, why is this conversation happening now?
So the main reason it's happening, Hadoop is just too damn slow. So a lot of people have gone in and said, I need to capture everything. And now the analysts are into it, and it's a batch-oriented system. The jobs take a long time just to even set up. And I know that when I'm in my intellectual flow, I want to get results stack.
So Hadoop sort of gave us the possibility of capturing and holding on to two
right.
orders of magnitude more data than we would have
and distributed
before.
And distributed because
right.
that's how you scale. Right?
But now, so now the analytical tools are needing to catch up to where we can have the same kind of rate of interaction with it that we would have had.
Right, yeah. It's the typical tech cycle, right?
Yeah.
We get a dog on a bicycle, then we criticize his style.
Is that an English
aphorism? You never heard that? It's not how well the dog rides the bicycle. It's that he's riding a bicycle. But it is, and it's driven by... It's not just analysts. Look, every developer wants to program interactively. Otherwise, we'd be still shoving punched cards into machines because that's probably still a lot more
right.
more
but
efficient.
I'm thinking about from the data
yeah.
perspective is that you know the reason you're throwing all this data in is to hopefully do something with it. And the kind of obvious thing is to
how much
you know,
how much is this, so the in memory. I mean, how much of this is a factor in data analyst interaction versus how much of it is being used to produce the back ends of systems that are fully automatic.
Yeah, that's a hard split to like quantitatively describe because when someone needs it for the recommendation engine, the kind of classic why you need real time, there's a very intentional build development, I need this piece in.
Mm-hmm.
And then once it's done, it's kind of done. Where the analytic piece tends to be a process that's ongoing. So when you think about the opportunities are around anyone who's like doing data center analysis. Like that's a big streaming data thing where you'd want real time tools in that. But once it's done, it's kind of done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you
right.
might tweak your algorithms and stuff. It's just a different.
So,
but I mean, are in memory systems being used to feed those kinds of things?
There definitely are. I just can't say that one is more than the other.
Yeah.
My sense is that there's more on the analytic side
yeah.
than that. But part of that might be that. These are big projects. These are like process architecture things, the kind of things people talk about. The individual projects just aren't as, I don't know, people aren't as verbal about them or whatever, but it's like, okay, there's rich relevance and companies that do that kind of work. Well, they went out and built something that they're incredible, right? That they do all this stuff. And people like Scale Out and Grid Game, they help with caching and really deep memory management so that you can do a lot and figure things out on the fly.
As you put it, is Hadoop always going to be too damn slow? Or is it, I mean, is this fundamental to the architecture that it's going to remain batch-oriented?
Well, people are putting stuff on it to, you know, I think what you'll see is this is layering. Is that,
yeah. I'll take this a bit, because then the future of Hadoop is, you know, Hadoop 1.0 had this wonderful distributed file system. There's only one thing you could do in each node, which was the MapReduce job, right? And then, you know, even Hive, the data warehouse on top of it, relies on MapReduce underneath. So, you know, your typical SQL query still takes 10 minutes to execute
right.
or whatnot. And people have obviously recognized that's too slow. But, you know, right from 3 years ago, you know, 3 years ago when you probably say Hadoop burst onto the popular scene, there was already in planning Hadoop 2.0, which is this thing called Yarn, which is in a sense really turns Hadoop into a distributed scheduler for any kind of job you might want, any kind of program you might want to execute. Doesn't even have to be in Java; it could be, you know, Python or any binary you can create. So it's a lot more general purpose than that. Which I think, incidentally, they might have some marketing issues trying to get people's heads around the idea. It's become a general purpose distributed computing machine. So the first things we'll see on top of that is not only a faster MapReduce, I think we'll see maybe 4 or 5 times faster MapReduce coming out quite soon because everybody needs that in the first place. But we'll also see this framework evolving to support in-memory computation on each node. Basically, anything you think of, you can stuff it inside
right.
Hadoop in the future. I mean, this is like 2-3 years out.
And the reason I ask, so, in terms of the overall data architecture, you know, you've got transactional systems and they're crunching away, and now you're bringing in unstructured data from other sources you maybe would have ignored before if you're a typical enterprise or whatever, because
yeah.
you just wouldn't have any way to do anything with them. And now you've got, you know, this two orders of magnitude more data in total than you used to have. And so you've got these fast in-memory analytical tools coming online,
mm-hmm.
but you still ultimately have all this heavy data sitting in these big, you know, sitting in Hadoop or sitting somewhere that you put it, and you've got to get it in and out of your in-memory system in order. It sort of begs the question, what's the bigger architecture that makes you not... So now you're an analyst, your queries run fast in memory, but you're spending half a day getting data in and out of it when you decide to change the question.
That's the argument. I mean, you know, that I don't think there's much dispute that HDFS is going to be the center of gravity for these new architectures, because simply everyone's put all the effort put in the data in there, and there's a lot of effort from the vendors going on to make sure they're getting it out back into the in-memory is transparent and as easy as possible.
Yeah, and I think it's almost like the Neo data warehouse or something.
Yeah. I've heard a couple people call it, talking about it, the data lake right now.
I just heard that today.
The one I heard...
The salt mine.
The one I got to tell you I heard about when we did the... this big data week in London, there's a guy talking about their architecture at the BBC, and they again have this big data pool. But in British style, he called it the data midden. Right. I have a pile of my data shoving there, and then let's put it out. And this is like the seriously the project name for this.
The
data midden.
Yeah. But I think that's why people, like, I think the more sophisticated people are building in an ETL. Mm-hmm. That brings it out of these ingestion engine parts and putting it into something that's pretty usable.
Yeah.
And that if you're an analyst and doing a project, you might be able to use that common space, or you spin it your own. And now you're spinning half a day the first time.
Yeah,
but once it's spun,
like,
out, you can keep doing
so,
it.
So, I mean, one of the advantages people often ascribe to systems like Hadoop is that it's, it's schema on the way out rather than schema on the way in, but now you're sort of just moving that schema problem to ETL.
You can't analyze.
But what I'm trying to dive into is the question of, if you're an analyst and the thing that matters isn't just the interaction time of a query, it's the interaction time from the moment I have a question to the moment I have an answer, which may involve ETL, asking the question in multiple ways, maybe some more ETL when I realize I didn't get all the data I needed to answer the question effectively the first time, eventually getting my answer. When you look at that whole process, then how these in-memory data management systems interact with the rest of it matter as much, perhaps, as the interactivity of the in-memory itself. Does that make sense, or am I...
No, I understand what you're saying. I think it probably depends on the problem somewhat, but...
Yeah.
You do have to kind of like sift through a problem, and it's usually a staging or a ladder where you first, what do I even have, right? It's like, we call them freaks, but we often freak things, which is doing frequency distributions. State, there's a state column in a lot of data. Well, if it's the U.S. and there's more than 60 or 70 states, you know there's a data quality issue that you're going to have to address before you go much further.
Right.
So I'm using that as a representative case, but those are the kind of things you got to look at. So there's going to be something that's there, but at some point, you've got things organized, and now you're trying to answer the question, or questions are coming to you in the data. What do I do next? And that's the part where you really want to stay in the flow. Would it be great if everything was set up? It would, but it's hard to anticipate that every question is going to have a data structure
But no, I don't think that's what I was implying. I was just implying that partway through the problem, you realize there's another piece of data inside the organization you need. And so if it takes you a day to get that, the fact that your interactivity was on the scale of minutes no longer really matters.
But I think that's fair. That's a fair enough thing to say. But on the other hand, the contrast is, it's not taking you 3 months, several meetings with IT and the sign-off of the VP to do it anymore. Because it's going into the data lake, as it were. It's not affecting any warehousing system that's already in production with whatever.
I
think that's the thing.
Yeah. One of the things I would say is that the in-memory probably isn't... Not that it's not for everyone. It's that if that's the case, if the scenario you're describing is very common, then maybe you're spending money in the wrong kind of area. But... at a lot of places, I'm going to use kind of Netflix did a really good presentation at the Strata in New York about their system, where a lot of people hit a piece of their system and they made this kind of common thing. Well, making that piece more efficient for everyone is great.
Right. They're kind of paving the cow paths data architecture.
And then if anyone else, since it's there, can throw their stuff in, and now they get, when it comes to the interactive part, it's there to use.
That's why I think actually one of the... We were talking about it earlier. One of the big opportunities that people haven't filled yet is this locating data and how all the data is managed and how you can get the bits to glue together. They obviously have some kind of a proactive team on it, but the BI industry has been gaga over self-service analytics for years, and I don't know how successful they've been to one degree or another, but that same scenario is obviously going to have to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And because the data is so much bigger and so much more different, I don't know that we can do the ontological, careful approach that was tried and semi-worked in BI. It seems to me we're going to have to figure out a webby way of doing data discovery and cataloging and dependencies too, right? If this piece of data disappears, mm-hmm. whose production system goes up?
Yeah,
there is a bottoms-up versus top-down kind of way of thinking about that. Yeah.
Right. So I worked at a database company in the late 90s, and I built the data warehouse infrastructure there. And one of the things we did is we ran a query at 5:30, maybe at 5 in the morning, because we knew that the database manager would peg the tables in our query in memory, and we could then start serving the East Coast people of their queries, and they would run in memory.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd run like way faster than they otherwise would if everyone had to keep loading the thing in. So even back then, we were doing things
mm-hmm.
to try to support one group of users so that they could get pretty fast queries. And like anything, there's, you know, carving a sculpture is that there's some things that are worth carving out because that's your workflow.
So what technologies are kind of rising to the top in this right now? Like what kinds of things are jumping out in your mind or that you see people actually using or that just seem really interesting? Or
I'll kind of answer that in two ways. One is people are like, I don't want to say building stuff, but they're building like their own things. So like MetaMarkets, an advertising marketplace company, has built Druid.
Mm-hmm.
And they've open sourced that because they get more people behind it, something that they need can work. So the kind of leading edge folks are starting to take pieces or build their own. And then in the commercial space, SAP has put a big push behind HANA. That's created quite a wake.
And Druid, is that multi-node?
Yes.
Is it time optimized for time series?
It's optimized for time series.
Now, is HANA also multiple node, or is it a single?
Yes, HANA is multiple node. In fact, HANA claims to support simultaneously both transaction and analytic volumes. That's a pretty big claim. I don't know anyone who's doing that, but I can't say that I know much about like a survey of HANA users. But what HANA has done is created this information wake of in-memory being a legitimate space because they've made an investment in it. They're giving out to startups. They've got a program for...
What machinery does that run on?
It's pretty much commodity hardware. You want a lot of RAM.
Okay.
You know, so they're kind of beefy.
I wasn't sure if it was an appliance or whether it was...
No, you know, and I don't even know if HANA sells an appliance, if SAP sells an appliance for it. When people do appliances, as modern IT has evolved, I mean, there's some IT shops that have a lot of kind of intellectual capacity, and there's some that really appreciate when things are all wrapped up and managed by someone.
Well, there's the aspect of the appliance that's wrapped up and managed. There's also the aspect of specialized hardware being in there in some cases. I just wondered if there was a specialized hardware requirement.
Most of these, no one has specialized hardware requirements. Even if they're using the L1, L2 caches, they're expecting an i86, I don't know if it's called i86 anymore, but that common architecture, how you address those caches, a C code.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things, a lot of things are written in C
because
it's memory. So the thing that everyone hates about C, the malloc, end up being an important part of making in-memory data stuff work. And then the other thing we're seeing is just that in-memory has become like columnar was maybe a few years ago, that it's either a feature or an important part of the product because as I mentioned earlier, the scarce resource of memory means people need to throw stuff in. And so you're seeing more ability to put stuff in memory. And the one that's kind of interesting is Spark and Sharp out of the AMP lab at UC Berkeley, where they've made it very explicit and they've created a kind of common programming paradigm for all the stages of how the work is done. And what's interesting about that is MapReduce is really effective for some jobs and really ineffective for others. And one of the reasons you might need to move things out of a Hadoop environment is you've got a particular kind of machine learning you need to do. Well, you need to move it out so that you can support that kind of work. With the Shark architecture, you can actually use the same programming style for all your kind of workloads. And that's, I don't know, that's really helpful because you can context switch without... You context switch on the problem, not the tool.
So is that project emerged from the lab and is being used in production or near production?
Yeah, it's near. I'd call it near production. They're cranking stuff out all the time.
Yeah,
I know Ed was the chair of Strata, and some of the most crowded sessions were the Spark Shark
sessions. I would be very surprised if we didn't see several startups come out of that.
I was kind of wondering when that soon. Yeah,
it would be. I know there's one or two who are using it in scalable production that you know, probably don't want to talk about in the podcast, but actually, no, they presented at the Strata, the Clear Story Data, doing that massively for a hosted analytics service. Mm-hmm. So they have a huge amount of data from Twitter and all kinds of information providers. They also upload all their customers' data. So that's, I think, a pretty good test of scalability when you have multiple organizations.
Yeah, I will say, I do know that a lot of people are starting to bring it in one way or another. Yeah. So like Platfora has its analytic layer. And the Platfora architecture mm-hmm. is very similar to what I described, where there's an ingestion piece and then there's something for the BI people to use. The new Pivotal, mm-hmm. which is GreenPlum and VMware, what they've done is taken their Gemfire in memory and they're trying to package that in with the GreenPlum analytic database, which also sits on Hadoop, right? So you're starting to see this notion of this stack, and that the reason it's offered is that for many people it is a viable thing. You might as well improve that part if you can, because the incremental...
Yeah. And but is Pivotal going to continue to offer that stack as something in-house, or is their model primarily going to be a cloud services for that stuff?
I don't know. So they're not really going to have their, do you say PaaS?
Platform as a service, right?
Yeah, platform as a service. Yeah. They're formulating it now. So they've announced that their web page has it, but you can't buy it, right now. Whether they think they're going to do more of one or another, yeah, I don't know. But that's going to be one of the options that they are planning on.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that in-memory, there's this focus on it right now because it's an important enabler, but actually, in a year or two, if we're still talking about it as a distinct thing, rather than it'll kind of be just like an engine under the covers, and we'll expect relatively consistent access to a data platform, and it figures out the clever stuff.
Right. I think it'll be a little more hands-on than you're describing, in that you'll probably have to identify and build in-memory things for unusual requests,
right,
at least to spin it up. Mm-hmm. So it'll never, I don't think we're going to see that kind of like complete transparency.
More like an annotation on the data to say this is frequently used.
That's right. That people will need to care about this in design, you know, in the space, that these are the kind of formal data structures. In fact, let me just use like kind of a framework, is that if you start off with your common queries, you're going to create like a formal data structure. And I don't mean formal, just that it's something that gets updated every day or every hour or whatever the frequency needs to be. And a lot of people hit this, or relatively many people hit it. And then an analyst comes in and starts doing something. It's valuable. Now you change that from informal to formal. And I think that process, that might be where it goes in memory, right? Is that I want a lot of people to hit this. This has been valuable. Or I want to hit this often because it answers a question I need to answer.
And you don't think we could do that automatically with machine learning or something itself, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Teradata does it inside the box in a sense, right? I mean, they move stuff to hot disks and colder disks and all that stuff.
The metaphor is from the web, where Memcached do this all the time.
Caching,
the notion of hot, warm, cold.
Yeah.
That's definitely going to be part of it. And you can move data around. I'm thinking more about the data structures themselves, how you organize the data for the analysis. That you can see what data elements are being hit, but you can't tell that, boy, someone should really reorganize this to make the drill up and drill down that's appropriate, or whatever that...
Sort of the logical proximity.
Yes.
Or whatever.
This is one of those 80-20 problems, right?
It does seem to me like in a way, it seems like big data, if you will, it's like one big broken abstraction, in the sense that for a long time data was neatly abstracted away, and you know, you sort of either went at it with SQL or you went at it through Hibernate and nobody else had to know anything about it. And this stuff does force us once again to have a little bit more sense of how things are working, what the hardware is.
I
don't know how long that'll last.
Yeah, because one of the things that's happened with this is we've been talking about this space for quite a few years. And we started hearing this notion of, I want to buy me a data. I want a silver bullet that answers my questions. And it's really a process. Yeah. It's really something you have to internalize and think about. And there's art to how you set things up so that you can make the science.
do its magic.
So are the primary use cases driving this, though, the interactive analyst stuff that you talked about?
That's certainly...
And is that true also, like, with what HANA's doing in enterprise? Is that primarily what people...
Yeah, and I'm basically thinking the HANA case, maybe someone anecdotally on some meetups I went to. But that seems to be where more of the interest is in. And I think it has to do with there's just fewer projects around the real time. So...
So what would that look like? If I'm on eBay and traditionally I've had a few hundred terabytes in Teradata and 4 or something or 10 or whatever the number is now, petabytes in Hadoop, and I start to bring this stuff in, what's that look like in their world? Like, where does it fit? How does it kind of...
As an analyst, I think it looks exactly the same as it did before. You fire up Tableau or your whatever you're using to write SQL and you fire it off. I honestly don't think it looks any different.
Yeah, and I think the thing is, so let's say you have a...
So you've added some infrastructure that's got a cluster of in-memory stuff. You shove some data.
If I have a Teradata in-house, I'm going to start pulling stuff from Hadoop into the Teradata. That's because I've already got an analytic framework, the connections, the tools, just what I was describing. I got Tableau talking to it.
Right.
Now I've got these other data sources. Well, I've already made a decision I'm not putting in the Teradata for whatever reason. But... what I want to analyze out of that, I've already got a Teradata middle layer. I don't know if that's the right word.
Well, if you talk to Teradata, they're saying, well, you might use Asta for that and take stuff from...
That's right. I mean, they would probably say, why did you bother with Hadoop? Why didn't you throw it all in here? But the point is that there's this middle thing that is geared towards the analyst.
So where would a Spark or Shark fit into that kind of world, I guess?
It would replace the Teradata. So this would be someone who hasn't made that investment.
Okay.
And, you know, Shark, the query language, is Hive. Is a version of Hive. So it's very SQL-like, and people are trying to build SQL connectors.
Okay.
I think at this point it would be leading edge to put Spark Shark in. You probably need some engineering talent.
Maybe people wouldn't be ready to do it, but that's where it would fit.
This is the place where the analysts and the people who need data are going against, and not as much touching the ingestion piece of it.
So is the because of the scale of data now, the thresholds we're hitting, I mean, is the era of the spinning disk database for interactive analytics receding, dead, gone?
It's receding. If money was no object, right, I would much rather have an all SSD system than a disk system. And given that people have their druthers around this stuff, I think that you'll see a lot of it. Performance is helpful. Even if it's only, when you were talking before about kind of this flow where, gee, who cares if it's interactive, you got all these other delays. Well, it almost doesn't matter. It's like having a fast compiler.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
Even if compiling, you're spending more time writing code, you still want that part to be fast. And the same with queries. You still
Exactly. I think, I was thinking about this, you know, because we're on the edge and we see the future as it happens, and everyone's still stuck with the spinning disks, right? Back in the 50 states or whatever. But I think there's one thing here that might drive it being faster, which is that big data is being conceived of as a business problem and not just an IT world thing. And I think if the understanding comes into businesses that putting this amount of data and processing this quickly is really going to make us competitive or give us a new project, I think we might see a transition in the technology turn over faster than we might have done if it was purely a case of revving the tech, to be faster, cheaper, bigger storage.
That's right. And I think what's driving that is that there are a few edge case industries, and finance and marketing or advertising are the two that are most there. It is worth their while. And they're building those applications we're talking about where the real-time part is important. So in a way, the analysts get some of the exhaust from that these real-time things are being built. So there are industries that do matter. They're relatively price insensitive, so they're willing to pay for these extra performance boosts. They have a sure ROI, and once it's there, then it starts becoming more available for everyone else.
Now, this might be a stupid question, but is all this stuff read-only? Or is there any issue of persistence with any of this? I mean, you mentioned earlier that HANA claims to do transactional stuff, too. Are people actually using...
That is, in fact, when I wrote down the kind of like, I think about the dimensions of this problem, that the whole like, whether you've got failure is what happens when things fail. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that is about modern data is it faster to rebuild or to restore?
Mm-hmm.
They all have a write. I mean, you've got to be able to write into the memory. But there's lots of problems where from the raw to what you're going to really use, it's faster to just recalculate it than it is to have a backup and put that backup in, as long as you've got a log that can rebuild the raw stuff. So that's an equation you have to make. Some of the folks have decided, I don't care. Let's see if I can, Yark. I was trying to say Cray backwards. Yark has half a petabyte of RAM appliances, but it's not persistent. It's this is for really fast.
It takes a hell of a long time to recalculate half petabyte cache, though. I mean, it's
right, but it also would take a long time to restore it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I.O. is far slower than compute, right, in a lot of...
I wouldn't argue, yeah.
Right, in a lot of systems. And it becomes, as the data gets bigger, the I.O. becomes important. I mean, it's not germane to exactly this problem, but it's still faster to ship a disk by FedEx than to transmit data over the public internet.
Right. Although Amazon and Google are doing their best to turn that around by getting a lot more straight fiber.
That's right. I mean, they clearly are. Right. And like what you see San Diego did with their, I forget the name of the project, is they're trying to get really fast Ethernet all over to science, to support science. So that is an important consideration as you're picking them. You've got to decide what's important to your kind of work flow and work processes, whether you can handle the failure, and whether recovery is best from a backup or best from a recovery.
But I'm right. I mean, just to pick Jim's point up, is it like a more like a caching kind of system where if you do something involved writes, it's right through at this point. It gets written to persistent storage at the same time as you write it into the memory.
Yeah. Most of these things are not. They're like they're pulling something from a persistent memory. And they have
just writing into that.
Right. And I don't know too much about the transaction architecture in HANA and how specifically they're making those writes happen. But there's usually some kind of logging that goes on.
Yeah.
And that when you rebuild or recover, you're pulling from that log, and that log gets is where the persistence takes
place. It's hard for me to think of something that needs writes in such a massive volume as analytics needs reads.
Right. The big thing is the web. The web generates and sensors, right? Generate.
But even that's massive, right? That could be billions of rows a day. But that's still an order of magnitude less than what the reload of an analytic thing would. And if you've got to persist it, right, there's not much point in. I mean, maybe you have it available so you can do some kind of CEP on the latest data while the persistence is taking slower. But
I'm glad you said that. Because CEP is for the latest data. And if you're doing your analytics, like big analytics, strategic analytics, and you think you need CEP, I don't know, I think you really need to think about that. Because there's what's happening right now, and you might need to do tactical decisions, and you might want to marry that to profiles, right, that come out of the strategic analytics. But to think that you always need to have the most recent data to make every decision, I don't know, I think it's a misunderstanding of how people interpret and incorporate data into their decision-making processes. Mm-hmm. Some things do need to steep.
Well, so this kind of brings us around to where we started off, right, when we talked about analytic in-memory databases, rather, and you said, well, people are talking about real-time, and you said, well, you know, whether it's transactional, whether it's analytic, but kind of the whole flow of this conversation has actually come to be that the in-memory use cases are analytic in the sense that we're talking about. And yes, there is need for real-time stuff, which is basically complex event processing, but they seem to be apples and oranges.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. It's like, in this case, when we say real-time, we mean the analyst gets an answer in real-time, but against data that may not be real-time.
Whereas
oftentimes when we talk about real-time, we're talking about things like Storm as a way to put a real-time component on top of an offline store.
Yeah, Joe Hellerstein says, you know, do you mean real-time for robots, meaning that you're getting stuff that an autonomous thing can do something with the data and make the kind of decisions are like the automated car, the driverless car kind of stuff. That's clearly a very different scenario than the notion of having to make a decision in a short time frame. That's a tactical decision. Now, it should be based on strategic inputs to make it the best decision. And those are important projects, but they just have that notion of that not wide deployability to a lot of people that maybe a lot of consumers are using it, but not to the kind of analytic use of the data.
So One last question, and then we'll sort of wind this down for our long-suffering users and listeners. Given that sort of the state of the art of scale for these unstructured data lakes is on the order of tens of petabytes now, mm-hmm. what's sort of the state of the art of scale of these interactive in-memory systems that will be serving those? And is there anything that sort of matters about the relative ratio of those two sizes in terms of the kinds of questions you can ask?
Yeah. What's hard about answering that question is like whether you need multiple machines or not. Microsoft is in a study. Someone wrote a book, mm-hmm. an article in Quartz, the Atlantic tech thing about, a lot of data fits on a machine.
Mm-hmm.
And in-memory is really helpful when you're doing it at that level. So for most people, you can probably do things in a relatively small space. And then when you get bigger, and like I said, the sweet spot isn't this kind of 10 terabytes, then you can, this is about where you can expect to have interactive query, the notion of okay. getting an answer in a reasonable time that you can stay focused on what the problem you're solving. When you get to those bigger loads, these are the kind of problems that, the unreasonable effectiveness of data
mm-hmm.
things. And maybe the batch mode makes sense. Or maybe you can do something where you're batching things and mixing it up with more real-time things. The notion of like sharding your database. Historically, this is the way it's been. The last year, this is the way it's been. I've got an algorithm that combines those two. So I only need to be in the kind of smaller data space to figure out the current stuff that adds to this big batch jobs.
Well, if you're doing analytics in something that's limited to 10 terabytes and you're pulling from a pool that's on the order of petabytes, are you back to sampling then in order to fill that?
Or? Well, I mean, sometimes you will be, yeah. but hopefully what you're really doing is only taking the things you need. That the yeah. 10 terabyte limit is that these are the columns I'm using
okay.
and no more.
Or the time range
right.
or whatever.
That's right.
Okay.
And that you're not sampling. I mean, sampling is great. It's the best thing you can do if you
yeah.
can't use the whole thing.
But some, yeah, just put it in parenthetical, sampling never went away,
right?
But we say that we get, you can look at every data point, but when you're a developer and doing analytic work, you need to sample otherwise. You're stretched into weeks to write anything.
That's right. And I think it's a pretty common workflow is to say, I'm going to work with some samples, find out what's interesting in those, then I'm going to bring the whole thing in. But the whole thing will often surprise you. So
what do you think happens next, Roger? What's the biggest thing you expect to change here in the near term?
I think how we perceive memory and what, like SSDs and how much RAM a typical server has. I think that those are going to become a more germane part of how you size a server than how much disk space you have
mm-hmm.
In it. And so we'll just start altering our thinking around these faster mm-hmm. Data access hardware pieces, and the software will be keeping up with that change.
And beyond that, even into the cloud where you have a bunch of machines with different qualities and basically service management software that just goes and takes your load to exactly the right place in it to execute.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks, guys. This was interesting. I learned a lot.
Cheers.
All right. Thanks.